This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicide, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. We're at the home stretch, 158th episode of 170. Once again, I love an as-promised return. Once again, as promised, Connor Ratliff of Stepfathers, of the George Lucas Show, of ASCAT at the UCB in New York, a star of Orange is the New Black, is a part of the Gethard Show for the last 7 years. RIP, I hear.
Yes, just recently ended.
Oh, it's ended. But look, Connor is back for arguably one of the most powerful minutes. He blew our freaking socks off with a theory, finally, that actually makes sense in this movie, that it is the last 7 days of Neil McCauley's life. And now he's back for the minute that proves this guy's ethos. When you spot the heat coming around that corner, you got to be willing to let everything go in your life in 30 seconds flat. And so, sir, here we are.
It's such a profound moment. It's one of the most powerful moments in the whole movie. And that's saying something, you know. This has been a journey. You've been going through minute by minute. Every minute has something in it that's a treasure. And yet this is one of the biggest treasures of all emotionally. This is what it's all about. What do they want? You know, and the choices that they make. And it all comes down to this moment.
And they don't have to say a word. They've already said it to each other in the coffee scene. You know, Vincent, Michael Mann famously talked about, he goes, Vincent really wanted to take Neil to go get a cup of coffee, just like Charlie Adamson took the real Neil McCauley, because he knew that even though it was unorthodox, even though it was weird, he would learn something in that moment that he'd be able to use later. Mm-hmm. And in just the preceding minute, we talk about the glance. Vincent glances up and he catches Amy Brenneman's Edie in the car. He catches her. And it's that moment, you know, amongst the frenzy and chaos of all the people running around, and with our great friend Justin Armel, who's one of the extras that Al Pacino runs into in this scene, way back and joined the show. He was actually on there, so shout out to Justin. We've just gone past that moment, but it's the single woman in a car by herself that leads Vincent down this path, leads him down this way, and then we're going to start this minute. So, Connor, thank you so much for being part of the show again. You were a great guest before, and I'm so pleased that we got to hook up again to do this, so thank you. And we're on the downhill stretch of a marriage, my third, or like in heat parlance, on the downhill stretch of this podcast. Yeah. So thank you so much for being a part of it. Let's watch this insanely great minute, the 158th minute, together, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Ooh.
There it is.
There it is. Wow.
So good. He does
and
he does ever so slightly break his rule.
He does. It's just, and I don't remember. Did I say it on the podcast last time?
No, we didn't. This is where you get
okay.
to.
This is where I said, okay. So in that moment, and I did, this is something when I, the four times I saw Heat in the theater on original release, the first time in America, and then three more times in my first in month England. Of drama school in England, partly because I was homesick and it took me back. It made me feel like I was at home again. But by the fourth time, you know, that's a lot of times to see a movie that long and that intense in, you know, like I was literally seeing it 3 weeks in a row there when I was in England. And the third time was so close, I started looking at technical things. I started observing. That's where I noticed that it was 7 days. And when you got to that scene, it had occurred to me before that I'm like, oh, well, obviously that's the point where Neil walks away from the thing because literally the Heat has come around the corner.
Yes.
And I remember sitting in the theater counting when De Niro notices Pacino, and I've done it several. I always do it. I always count now when I get to the front. I cannot do it, but it's just over. At first, I was like, oh, it's not 30 seconds. So I was like, oh, maybe I'm wrong. But then I thought, no, of course, it's like 31. It's just slightly over 30 seconds.
Yes, and just a hair over.
And that's why, even though it's meaningless, he still leaves her. He still runs away. I do believe it is the difference between who lives or dies at the end of this movie.
100%. That
maybe instantly. Or if he had even left it at 30 seconds. Because there is that thing of like he's backing away from her, but he's still looking at her. And there's that last little turn and look and turn and look. And then there's the moment when he turns his back and runs.
Yes.
And I think he would have gotten away if he truly had stayed true to his 30-second rule.
Absolutely. It's the final it's the final nail. Because, because he spots him long in the distance. He comes down the steps. We just miss a hair of it, but he catches Vincent in his eye line.
And he's a fast runner. And in the coming minutes, there are a few moments where Hannah just barely catches a glimpse of him in the distance.
Yes.
And that 30 seconds could have been his getaway.
Mm-hmm.
And he found something that was important enough to him that you know, that's the discipline, and it violated his discipline. And there's no way that's a coincidence because it's a long sequence.
In the 158th episode, nothing has been a coincidence in this movie.
Nothing is. Yeah, and there's no way that Michael Mann. It's so carefully done that it doesn't call attention to it.
No,
because it's all about the emotion that. There's no, they don't cut to a clock. They don't, there's nothing about it.
How grating would that be? Someone please, one of the many amazing editors that have been on this show, just cut to like a really glaring countdown clock during this time. Someone just stitch it on there, throw it on YouTube. We'll post it on the One Heat Minute page. Just, you know, something silly.
You need a 24 style countdown clock. you need an audio flashback of Neil saying the lines that you hear it in the head. Like, there's so many ways.
And I just want an NFL ref to come in and just throw a penalty delay of game flag. Like he's just. Yeah,
he looks at Amy Brenneman and he literally sees the clock ticking out, like her face, like in old cartoons where characters get hungry and they turn the body turns into a chicken. She just turns into her head turns into a clock. It's so gracefully done for something that is like, you know, he says it twice in the movie and it would be very easy to call attention to it. It would be very easy to call attention to it, but I'm so impressed that it's, because it is one of those things that once you realize it, you kind of can't unrealize it. I never watch it now where I'm not aware of the fact that I'm like, oh, this has to take this long. It's not, you know, it's driven by the feeling, but like you could easily imagine a version of this where he sees Pacino just runs
yes.
and, you know, cut to Amy. There's, especially in a movie that is already a long movie, that's like an easy cut, which is just like, why don't we just have him see Hannah and run? Like, no, you have to have it.
No, you have to have it. And you have to have what I think is probably the elevating factor is Amy Brenneman's performance. Because mm-hmm. when he stops, like, she's looked at the chaos that he's orchestrated.
Yeah. She doesn't know that. Which is one of the funniest shots in the whole movie. The moment where it cuts back to her and there's just like sirens and everything, and she's looking around and she knows it's her boyfriend, she doesn't know what.
She has no clue. But when she sees him, mm-hmm. there's this amazing sense of relief. He even undoes the tie, and you're like, there is a sense of like, oh, that you can just sort of breathe for a split second. And as soon as he catches Hannah, we already know that something's going down, but there's this happiness on her face, this hopefulness. It's like, oh my God, he's going to take me finally out of this situation and we can just forget about this as another blip on the Neil McCauley radar, like in LA.
Yeah.
And then there's a horrific awakening on her face. Like when he stops and looks at her and he sort of starts to do this weird strafe, like glacially slow strafe to the left, like as if he's being lured by a magnet. Her face, her performance there is just so unbelievable because it's joy and relief and mm-hmm. then just this terrified realization that nothing that this guy ever said was ever going to override his program. He was going to do this.
And there's also, you know, the most recent viewing that I had of the whole movie, it did really occur to me that, like, Amy Brenneman's character, really, that her point of view in that plot line really is like, dating is hard. You know, like the fact that she is able to be convinced to go, because her initial reaction when she finds out about him,
yes,
you know, is exactly the reaction you would expect, which is, who are you? What is this? She runs.
Yeah.
And there is an aspect of, you know, even the next morning, she's like a hostage. She's like, what do you need from me?
It is a very awkward and gross scene, that scene.
And the fact that he is able to kind of turn her, I think, is a testament to how lonely it can be in the city. You know, the fact that he's able to convince her, I think in order to buy that, you have to buy that she's been through a lot and she is so lonely that she is able to rationalize this and go along with it. And her willingness to go along with it is immediately rewarded with another heartbreak, you know, like.
And she feels like a captive though. Like there's a first part of this scene. She's not a captive, mm-hmm. but you feel like she is. And we know what Neil will do. Like I don't think we've talked about it too much in the entirety of this podcast, but she's a captive and he'll kill her. Like is death on the cards if she doesn't do it? Has she seen too much? She knows him. Will she confess, give them a detail? Or is he just happy to discard her?
I can't. I mean it's never occurred to me. And I don't think I want to think about that in terms of I do think that he, in the same way that he, the same part of him that doesn't run the second he sees Hannah tells me that he wouldn't kill her unless something else would have to happen. Like,
yes,
if she said, I'm going to the police right now or something like that. But I think if he just left her, or if she just said, I don't want to go with you, I do think he would let her live.
Because she doesn't know enough. She doesn't know enough to be a problem.
She doesn't know enough, and I think he does care about her. And I don't think that he's – like, he's not a psychopath. He's not
– No, he's not a psychopath. He's a high-functioning sociopath, but he's
– Yes.
He's not quite a psychopath.
I think there would have to be a third element that's not in here to get him to the point where he would kill her. Yeah. She would have to suddenly be like, I'm going to go to the cops or, you know – And I don't think he gets that sense from her. And I think he is the kind of person who, like, if he senses something is a certain way, he's confident in those. Like, he is confident in his instincts.
Yes.
You know?
There's the wonderful scene where, and so like I said, there's a captive feeling because she's with him, mm-hmm. and she's there begrudgingly, and he's like, "Come with me," and she just looks completely betrayed. And that the amazing roadside scene where mm-hmm. he says, "Like, I don't want to live my life unless it's with you," essentially, to paraphrase. Right.
Yeah.
In that moment, she turns, and then there's hope. And so they go through. They both have their tunnel moment. In the tunnel moment, he can't escape his instinct and impulse to take out Wangar. He can't. He's slavishly adhering to this. You know, mm-hmm. famously,
and he laughs about it a little bit. He has an expression on his face that's kind of like, "I can't believe that I can't let this go." Yes. But I can't.
Yes.
You know?
And Matt Zolzaitz, who recorded that episode with me in the tunnel, said, you know, what do we call tunnel vision? You know, it's myopia. You know, it's like, you know, mm-hmm. that he's solely focused. He can't see anything else except what his programming is in that moment. And tragically, in that moment, she feels like it's a new start. It's a rebirth. She's going through the tunnel and she's like, all this yeah. shit, we're just going to leave it behind. We're nearly at the airport. It's all good. And then
I almost wonder if she's in shock during that post roadside scene, because she seems strangely at peace in that tunnel drive. Like, she seems
absolutely.
Like
absolutely, she's serene.
Yeah, and the watching her in this minute when she sees him backing away, and she doesn't know what it is, but she knows that something's happening. She has no sense of it. Like, Al Pacino runs by her and she doesn't even clock it. No. Like, she doesn't. She doesn't know why he's running away. So from her point of view, he goes inside. I have one thing to do. And all of a sudden there's, you know, sirens and fire engines and everything. There's chaos everywhere. She doesn't know why. She doesn't know what. But he's caused this. And he comes out. Looks like everything's fine. And then he reacts. There has to be a part of her that is like, is it me? Like, because he's looking at her. If you look at it from her point of view, he looks at her, and then all of a sudden, it's almost like she turned into a pumpkin or something. It's really almost like a spell is broke. He looks at her like there's something wrong.
Yeah,
and
he's like, I have to break everything that I said before. Everything that I said before is a lie.
He doesn't say anything. He just looks horrified.
Yes,
and from her point of view, like, it almost like this poor woman that goes through all of this stuff, the last thing, almost you wonder whether it feels like she's being gaslit or something, where she's like, he looks shocked by her, to look at her like, I can't. And then he runs away. That's gotta be one of the most confusing things of in a series of very confusing things that happens to her, is at the end, he goes inside, comes back out, smiles, and then all of a sudden his expression changes and he runs away from her.
It's a hell of a way to end a Tinder date. It's a hell of a way to end a Tinder date.
And it makes you wonder, you know, we don't see her again.
No.
Does she drive away? How long does she stay there?
I have no idea.
Does she go home? It's not her car.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are he left it running though, right? The car is running.
The keys are in the car. Yeah.
He's in the car. Does she park it somewhere and then leave it? Does she, you know, what does she do? She's an accomplice yes. to a cop killer. I mean, can you imagine if this, I mean, the film ends exactly where it needs to end. But if you imagine a version of this movie that is 5 to 10 minutes longer and just follows up on what happened, do you imagine she's in any kind of legal trouble at the end of this?
I think maybe they'd visit her. They'd have to follow it up. Maybe.
Do they know about her?
Yeah. Well, Vincent clocked her. But as you said, once he saw her, she was just like the cue.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about her once he sees Neil. He's heads down. Neil's got the head start. As you said, if he leaves in 30 seconds, he's got more of a head start, and he gives Vincent an extra 10 seconds of catching up time. You know, this all is catching up time. And so Vincent's head is down when he streams past her.
Yeah. And it always strikes me in that end that Neil runs like a machine.
Yes.
And Vincent runs like an animal.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That, like, Neil's run is very much like a Terminator or like a sophisticated piece of robotics or machinery. Doesn't look like an animal. It doesn't look like any animal.
No.
It's cold. It's mechanical.
It's a guy who is trained to run long distances away from police. Like he's put in the time.
Vincent is like a cheetah or a hawk or he has the speed. It almost looks like his face becomes.
Yeah, he's
He has a beak. He has and it's the look in his eye too. That like Vincent has a look in his eye, which is like I have my prey in sight.
And Vincent's run there, it's De Niro looks like he could run. He can run faster and more machine-like, but Vincent mm-hmm. seems like a force. Like I'm going to run you down. I don't care
he's
how
hungry for it.
I don't care how long you run. I'm going to be here. Yeah. I'm going to get you.
Yeah. And we don't hear in the car. The radio's not on, right?
Nope.
The radio's never on, unless mm-hmm. they're listening to the score to heat in the tunnel. Unless they're listening to that.
A little bit of God moving a little bit of God moving over the face of waters from Moby.
Yeah. Neil has his Moby CD in the single disc player. Neil McCauley wouldn't have a multi disc. He wouldn't have a disc changer because you got to be able to unload those discs in less than 30 seconds.
Would he ever have a book on tape? Would he have a book on tape?
I wonder. I mean, as far as we can see, when Neil drives, it's in silence, right?
Mm-hmm.
He just listens to the like it's a music. So just do we ever have any indication that Neil McCauley likes music? He has an empty, silent house.
Yep.
The
closest to a musical note we have is the sound of a Beretta hitting a glass table gently.
Yeah, just a light percussion.
Ting, ting. Like, just that. That's Neil's music. That's about as much music.
Does Hannah... I mean, we see Hannah at the club. We see him walking into that music in the club.
Oh, he dances. He and Justin, they dance. And
they dance. There's music.
There's music.
This is how... that's interesting. Yeah, because I can't think of any examples of music in Neil McCauley's life.
Nothing.
Presumably there was music in that restaurant they went to, but that's incidental.
The music of Neil McCauley's life is just the clutter and the hum of like humanity around him. He's not he's not a leisure guy. Like he goes and buys books on metals because of a job. Like he's got an order and a sense to him. Like Vincent at least is clutching to the idea that he's a social animal. Vincent's not. He's a hunter. But he's clutching to that idea. So in these brief moments, in these brief windows, you know, it, as much as a reward for his crew who have to put up with him as for the wives, he's doing what he's got to do to be a part of it. But then when Vincent gets back to his hotel room, as an example, you know, just prior to the tragedy with Lauren, like, he doesn't go in and whack on a CD.
That's a hotel room, though. That's a hotel. You don't always have that option.
No.
I do think – I mean, I always think about Amy Brenneman's character as that's a very sad plot line. She doesn't deserve any of this that happens to her. She's a complete victim of – she flirts with the wrong guy in the restaurant. You know, it's just bad luck.
Yes.
And you imagine she's had bad luck her whole life by the fact that I think the only way that she goes along ultimately with Neil is because she must have had worse experiences than this.
Or is this the one experience that just makes her like not have fun anymore?
I don't know. An optimistic view is that the 30 seconds where he runs away from her might be the best thing that ever happened to her.
It is the best thing that ever happened to her.
Yeah, because even if they were to go to whatever island or whatever, Neil McCauley would go nuts. He thinks he wants something else.
No.
He thinks he wants open a little coffee shop somewhere. There's no way he wants that.
Would never order a coffee from Neil McCauley.
It would be perfect. Don't you think? Like he would do it with – it's a service. Like if he really committed to it, the customer service would be impeccable. There wouldn't be much warmth, but you would get what you ordered and it would be
sublime.
It would be chemically the coffee you ordered would be chemically so precise.
Yes.
It would be lacking some human touch, but it would be like technically perfect coffee.
Yes. But what I'm saying is you couldn't imagine him shackled to a spot.
No.
He's like a blistering, he's a blur. He's moving. He's in a car in silence. He's the brief and rare moments where he goes back to his little cave. He's there like looking at the ocean. It's moving. He's lured by that movement. Like there's something happening. There's something there. So the idea that he's going to stay still is just that's where I wrestle in the best possible way with him and Edie. Because, you know, after you've watched it as many times as both you and I have at this point, it's like you watch it and you're like, you know that he's trying to be desperately sincere and romantic and this is something that he wants. And you know that she is just a genuine person. But I can't help but feel like, Neil, you know yourself. You know your program so well. Why are you lying to yourself? Like, this is a lie. It's all a big...
He would like to like it. He does like it, and he wishes that was what he really wanted. I think he's convinced himself he wants it. I think if he actually was to go and live that free and clear life with Edie, the same part of him that says, I'm never going back to prison, I think he would end up viewing that freedom as another prison.
Yes.
And I think he would escape from it. And
I'll tell you what, there'd be some high line burglaries in New Zealand that mystified the police there. Absolutely. Yeah. Without any doubt.
Absolutely.
Edie would suddenly have this majestic necklace and she'd be like, oh, where did you?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind. It's an heirloom.
You could imagine such a beautiful sequel to Heat visually. Like, imagine the sequel shot in New Zealand to Heat of Neil McCall. Landscapes in New Zealand, you know. I mean, what would be the biggest heist in New Zealand? What would be the high end targeting that Neil McCauley? What do you think would strike his fancy?
The big towns. So there's, you know, North and South Island. The big sort of cities in New Zealand are like Auckland and Christchurch, and so it would be one of those. It would be one of those two. It would be like a heist that would happen in like one of the main towns.
Both. I'd do both. There'd be two big heists.
And you can drive. You can drive multiple jobs going. You can drive New Zealand in like 40 hours or something. You can drive the island length, you know. So it wouldn't be long before he was bored. He'd just go to Sydney and, you know, come over into Australia and go to Sydney and start working.
Yeah. Oh, it's a shame. It would have been a real fascinating thing to just see a sequel where he's just quietly behind Edie's back doing these large scale heists while still putting up the front that he gave it up.
Still working at the coffee shop with Edie's art on the walls.
Yes.
Serving absolutely pristine coffee.
Yeah. I mean, the expression on De Niro's face in this 30 seconds is him. It's De Niro realizing that it's not going to happen for him. And I think he also knows in that 31 seconds, he knows he's being sloppy. He knows that he should run, and he doesn't. He knows from the second he sees Hannah, he knows exactly what he should do, and he can't. He needs to look at her a little bit more, even though it's just a few seconds. It's not it's a completely irrational thing for him to linger, because I guess part of him is probably, some part of his brain is running the numbers. Is there a way out? But I don't even think that, Connor.
I think he knows the minute he knows the second he sees where Hannah's in, he knows that they're boxed in. He probably knows that when he gets out of this hotel, he's got to pluck her out of that car. And he's got to blend. Just say there's no Hannah. I imagine in an alternate universe where there's no Hannah there, he plucks her out of that car in amongst that chaos and just blends into the crowd, and they make their way back to the airport. Like, the airport is literally that close. So they might be slightly late for their flight or whatever, but he's going to make his way to the airport without a tail and blend into all the chaos that's streaming out of that hotel.
Yeah.
But right when he sees Hannah, he knows there's no way out. He's like, because his presence is flagged, And
yeah,
and someone who can eyeball him in the crowd is there. And so for me, he's like etching her into his memory in denial. He's like, yeah. I'm going to go and I just can't not look at her for 30 seconds. I'm going to try and adhere to my rule.
And he knows that there's no version in which he can run with her.
No.
Like, there's no version in which the two of them run away.
She's not like
away.
Linda Hamilton from Terminator 2. Like, she can't jump out of that car and leap fences and carry a gun and fire it at Vincent.
Yeah. And if even if he were to try, it would implicate her.
Yes.
You know, that, yeah, there's just so much going on for a minute in which only one thing really happens, you know?
Yes.
There's one thing that happens, but there's so much to that one thing. And, you know,
can you
and
imagine
for Vincent,
trying to write this? You know, that exercise of like, if you've never been a screenwriter before, there's a very basic exercise that people do that they tell you, just go home and try and write down everything that happens in like your favorite scene of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now in 60 seconds, how do you articulate?
Yeah.
How do you articulate what happens in that 60 seconds?
Yeah, he sees her. She sees him. He sees Hannah. Oh, he looks back to her. She's looking at him. She's like, what? He's looking at her. He's like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Just like, we look over to Hannah. He's running. You know, it's one of those things where it would if you really wrote it out, it would almost sound comical because we just keep coming back. Meanwhile, Hannah's still running out. You know, just like he's backing up a little. He's looking at her. She's looking at him. She's getting out of the car. She's like, where are you going? He's backing away. Meanwhile, Hannah's still running. You know, it's just the rhythms of it. I mean, why is the screenplay for this not – it has never been published in any form, like the shooting script, right?
It's around, but it's not – there's online versions of it. It's not like a beautiful, pristine book to buy. Otherwise, I would have it, and I'd be reading it along as we did this. But there's
– and is it the shooting script or is it a transcript? Like, is it like what Mann originally like wrote with his like
– There's a March 94 script, but I don't know if there's a proper shooting script.
Right. I wonder if I could read 1 minute of it, this would be the minute I'd want to read, is to see like what, how.
I think there's a one man show of you doing that, explaining that everything that happens, because it's my favorite thing, I think, maybe that we've done.
Yeah.
Is you going, she looks at he looks at her, she looks at him, he looks at Hannah. Yeah. Hannah's still coming. Hannah's running. Yeah. It's like the best worst story of that your friends are explaining a scene from a movie and you're like, what? I have no idea what's going on while you're talking, but I'm interested while you're saying every single word.
I did once perform in a show at UCB. There was a show that everyone was doing. It was a tribute to Liza Minnelli and everyone was doing different things during the show. And I came out as Liza Minnelli and and mentioned that I'd been friends with and I'd obviously worked with Bobby De Niro. But one thing that wasn't known was that we often went up for the same parts. And then I proceeded to act out the bank robbery scene from Heat as Liza in heels. And so it was me like for the part where he jumps up on the counter, I was like in heels jumping up onto a bunch of chairs that were lined up against one another. It was me doing an impression of Liza Minnelli, explaining everything about how your money is insured by the federal government. You won't lose a dime. But it was all done in a with Liza's flair and attitude. And it did everything up to the point of the shooting through the machine gun through the front windshield as Macaulay. It was a lot of fun.
Did anyone get, you know, where's the Zapruder footage for that? I'm desperate.
I think there's like, I'll see if I can find online. There's a few seconds of it somewhere online, I think. But I know of that show, you know, everyone else was doing things that were, you know, the people who come to the show, come to see Liza Minnelli bits. It was the one bit that was sort of, you feel there were pockets of the room that had seen Heat that remembered it enough to know, oh, that's what he's doing. There's a certain amount of bewilderment in terms of, the crossover between like diehard Liza Minnelli fans and fans of the movie Heat, not that it doesn't exist, but it's at least within that audience, it was only a smattering of people that I feel truly got understood what I was referencing. Well, I think there was some pleasure in seeing just the absurdity of it, even if you don't know what it is. I could tell there were people who were instantly like, I know this scene. Yeah.
One of the great scenes that we never got to see Liza Minnelli do in her entire life and career.
Liza would have been a great Neil or Vincent. She would. There's a version of this movie where Liza could have played both. You know what I mean?
Yes. 100%. 100%.
Yeah. She's a triple threat, you know.
Like, I often wonder if Neil really thinks that he's going to get out of here. You know, like, after all the carnage, he knows there's a lot of chaos. He's seen all the action. Does he really think he's getting away in this moment?
I think he does. I think the moment he's loosening his tie, I think he really thinks he's going. I think he's thinks he's done it. I think he thinks he's created enough of a mess that it'll camouflage.
That is a great point.
It'll camouflage. I think because he underestimates. I mean, the fact that Hannah is there on the scene, he just underestimates him, you know?
Yes.
I think if he thought there was a chance that Hannah was going to be
anywhere near there.
Yeah. Then maybe he doesn't turn around. But I think he's, you know, I mean, also, he convinced Edie to come along with him. That seems like it was a bigger, like, it seems like everything's going his way. That it's like, hey, this woman I've barely been dating. I've been dating her less than a week, and she found out I'm a bank robber and I've killed people.
I did the greatest heist almost in LA history. And
I've killed cops. I've killed cops. And she ran away in horror when she realized, and I managed to talk her into going away with me. I think at that point, I think that gives him maybe a false sense of, he can do anything. I think he feels slightly invincible, that he's like, not only did I get the girl, there's no reason for that girl to go with him in a sane world, you know?
No.
Like, they've been dating less than a week. And
yeah, being a cop killer and a bank robber is,
she found that out.
It should be a deal breaker.
I mean, unless I'm mistaken, this is their third date, yes?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it is.
The first date was we meet at the restaurant, we go look over the balcony, and we sleep together.
Correct.
The second date was he calls her up. He's like, I want to see you again. And I was worried it was only one night. Not for me, it wasn't. The third date is he comes over post-bankrupt.
The third date he pushes into her kitchen and has he's parched after all the bank robbing.
Fixes himself a drink. On its own, I posit this. Remove the cop killing and the bank robbery from the scenario entirely. Let's say she doesn't know about it. She doesn't have a working television. She hasn't heard about this. Just pushing into the apartment, fixing him a drink. For some people, that would be enough. It's like, this guy's bad news. He pushed into the apartment and fixed a drink and was a little bit grouchy.
In 2019. That would be enough.
Like, there's no fourth date.
In 2019, that is a huge red flag, and that is a Twitter story that you put up. Like, this douchebag came in and fixed himself a drink in my kitchen without even saying hello.
And the third date is him coming in there, keeping her there all night, and then does he leave? Does he leave the house?
No, he stays
with her.
He's hiding in Edie's house while he's arranging.
Yeah.
And Nate's coordinating an out. And so then
and when he goes over to Nate's, she's in the car.
She's in the car.
Yeah. So she doesn't get away from him. The third date lasts more than 24 hours, right?
Yes.
Maybe, or close to it anyway.
Close to.
It's
almost a 48-hour date. It's actually a 36-hour date by the time we're at this moment. They've been together for 36 hours.
Most of that date is not going well. You know? And
for at least 20 hours of it, or at least like 12 hours of it, she's not into it. It's the pre-tunnel.
Yeah, she's genuinely a hostage.
Yes.
The third date begins with him fixing himself a drink, running up the hillside and tackling her in the reeds. And so this is, you know, the fact that he convinces her to go away with him, to leave the country with him. I think, you know, beyond that, once he's accomplished that, and then he realizes, nah, I'm going to leave Wayne Grove. And he's driving. He's like, you know what? I can't have the girl. I can have the guy who betrayed my crew. I can get away with all of this. And it's, you know, it's hubris in a way that Hannah doesn't have that same thing. Like, Hannah has his moments that are the opposite of that, which is like, they're gone.
Yes.
It's over. Hannah gives up.
Hannah is so enamored in a way by them and their capability that as soon as they don't have them, he's like, he's gone.
Yeah,
he's like, I'm going to go sleep for a week. They're gone. Gone. I'm out. Gone.
Yeah. And whereas Neil, when things are going his way, he gets that high of like, I'm the best. I can do it all. I can get my revenge and my romance and I can have it. And, you know, you will never know. There's no way of knowing whether he would make a different choice if he knew that he wasn't going to get away with killing Wayne Grove. You know?
Yeah, it's tough. But for him to walk into that hotel, knowing that he's staying under there in a fake name, knowing that he's going to be watched by cops, he's only putting himself in a position to kill more cops, hurt more people, only to get there. He's playing a short odds game, but it's the fact that he just feels that the cops, this is where his moment of preempting Vincent. He would assume that Vincent thinks he's gone.
Yeah.
And that's one of the only things that gets him there, right? So you're spot on, and Vincent's like, they're gone, they're gone, they're gone. So in his mind, he is gone. There's no way the Neil who sat down in front of me in that coffee shop would say, would come back for this. Why would he do that?
Yeah. He wouldn't. He absolutely wouldn't.
But now he does. He does come back. And that's the cue.
And, you know, is there a part of him that would rather be caught than take the big risk? Is there a part of him that's hedging his bets? Because deep down, does he know that this is not, like, I always read it as straight ahead that when he's in that tunnel that he thinks, I'm going to go get him. I'm going to go get Wayne Grove. Is there a part of him that's also like, this is a fantasy I'm driving towards, whereas I know I can get Wayne Grove.
I think it's the madness and the conflict that come across his face in that moment, and the, you know, the fighting instinct versus impulse versus, you know, intellectualizing versus calculation. Mm-hmm. You know, I think all of those things could be true. Like every thought, conceivable thought that he could have in that moment is colliding. Yeah. And all that conflict is making him have all these weird reactions and this absolutely wonderful, you know, close up on his face, all happening all at once. And he reflexively goes back to what his instinct is, which is not leave a loose end. That guy screwed me over. That guy stopped this heist from going perfectly. He is the source of truth. And he's got it coming from screwing up the previous heist. He's dead. I can't rest and even move on to another job, let alone go, you know, right off into the sunset unless he's dead. I can't have him alive. And so he does it. But you're right about the hubris, though. Like walking into that hotel, you know, putting his head down as people, you know, as he sees, you know, people with shotguns behind the counter, LAPD people in there sort of glancing, you know, try not to draw too much attention to themselves, but also drawing attention to themselves. It takes a lot of balls to like walk in there and know that everyone's looking for you. Everyone's expecting you to come.
And especially for a guy who plans stuff meticulously. I mean, it's impressive to see the way that he, I think I said this in the last, episode that I did where I was talking about how, Neil is sketch and Vincent is improv.
Yes.
And you're watching Neil improvise a plan. Like the part where the security, the cop comes up behind him in the hallway and he backs up to him.
Yes.
Where you feel like he's caught. Neil is so confident with that. He's so confident the way that he deals with these, you know, unplanned moments, you know? He really does, it's just, he just can't stick it. You know, he can't stick the landing in this, you know, the fact that he gets away with everything that he wants inside that hotel, only to come outside and realize that he's had all these smaller, he's won every battle and he's about to lose the big war, that you're seeing a man who's, you know, this whole movie, the look on his face is not just about the loss of Edie. It's also about, I think, all of this was for nothing. Like, he's about to lose. It's all, getting Wayne Grove means he now loses his chance for anything, you know? That everything that he's done in the movie up to this point has led him to now I'm going to fucking have to run through the tarmac just to try not to get killed.
Yes.
Let alone achieve any of the stuff I want, you know? And Vincent in this minute is just he's just a dog going after a bone. He's just like,
he's got the scent. He's a hunting dog. He's got that scent, yeah. And he is running. He's like,
yeah,
he's salivating.
Yeah. And he's also, I mean, it's bleak, but he's also on a little bit of a winning streak because he just saved a young girl's life. You know, he's not, you know, his relationship seems like it's maybe over.
Yep.
His marriage seems like it's maybe over, but it ended on a heroic beat.
Yes.
You know, that like his ex-wife isn't going to hate him. He's the man who saved her daughter's life.
And then asked if she could make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, well, I got to go catch this thing I've been looking for. You know? Like, it's a little bit of a winning streak at the end as well, you know? That, you know, at the end of this day, you know, he's the one who, like, for all of the mess and chaos of, you know, this is a guy who just, you know, not too long before this, like, kicked his TV out onto the street, you know, and now he is on the way towards being a real hero, you know.
But at what cost?
His cost is smaller.
His life's pursuit, Connor. We're so close to talking about this minute. I can't. This is exactly where we're going to end. Ladies and gentlemen, we can't go any further because we're in the final pursuit. We're in the final chase. And we're with a man who not only is a star of things like Orange is the New Black and Search Party and The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is absolutely spectacular and he is spectacular in, but he's also the future administrator of the Vincent Hanna School of Improvisational Comedy and the Neil McCauley School of Sketch Comedy, Mr. Connor Ratliff. Mate,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. This is so good. 158 episodes in.
And what are you going to do when you get to the end?
This is my standard line until we actually experience it, until you've all there, and until I'm there recording it.
Yeah.
I'll probably be holding this podcast cold, dead in my hands. This podcast is my Neil McCauley. This is my everything. Tears will be welling up. I'll be looking off into the sunset and know that this one true pursuit, it's gone. And so God, I'm just going to have to let God moving over the face of waters just wash over me and we'll just have to see where it goes.
You just have to do – any future episodes are just listening to that Moby track.
Yes. Pretty much just in preparation.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try –
And people are going to try to get you to do some episodes where you go back and watch LA Takedown, and you're just going to say, I told you I'm never going back.
I told you I was never going back. And that is the exact answer that I'll give if people are like, you should do another Michael Mann movie, minute-by-minute podcast.
Yeah.
I told you I was never going back.
Well, best of luck. I'm looking forward to hearing how it ends.
Well, look, I'm going to throw it out there in the universe, as I always do. The final two episodes of the film, the final two episodes pre-credits are the 165th and 66th minutes pre-credits. I have a schedule which has obviously Connor's name on it for this episode. We talked about it when we even recorded his early episode. We found the minute, and for about a year, there's been two names across both of those episodes. That name is Michael Mann. So if the universe, if I just, you know, was sitting down buying someone a cup of coffee and I just, the universe told me that I could throw a thought out there and make something happen, it would be that Michael Mann is the person who is joining me for those episodes.
Oh, I think it's going to happen. I'm an optimist.
I think it is too.
I think it would be, you know, I hope I'm not, I don't think I'm going to be proven wrong in this, but I think what kind of universe would it be in which someone could do something like this and it wouldn't end that perfectly? I think he's going to hear the call.
And I hope that you guys listening, who are now at 158 episodes, actually more because they've done a few bonus episodes, there've been some little previews and teasers of upcoming episodes, and a couple of times where I had a couple of people who were desperate to do the same minutes, and I experimented with a crazy idea of having people do the same minute twice, or like different people do the same minute, yeah. which stopped almost immediately after it started.
Yeah.
But I would hope that he's on here too. That would be a pretty amazing, I think that'd be a pretty amazing end.
I also am totally willing to come back if you go back on your word and do LA Takedown and Robbery Homicide Division, the TV show. Because the thing is, like, I do on Twitter, I do these long, I'm currently in the middle of these, I do these long mega threads.
You're doing a Mickey Mouse mega thread for Mickey Mouse's 90th birthday.
Every day I'm chronologically watching every Mickey Mouse cartoon and tweeting about them every day. And I've done these things several times before. I did a Porky Pig thread. I did a Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote thread. I did an Elvis Costello thread where I went through everything he'd ever recorded over the course of 45 days. And these are these, like, you do these undertakings that are obsessively chronicling something. And when you get to the end of them, there is a feeling of loss.
Yes.
There's a tremendous feeling of, what do I do now? What do I do if I don't do this? Which is a very funny thing to attach to something like a Twitter thread or a podcast. When you get to the end of it, the loss that you feel, you only have to, I'll tie it back into the minute. When you hit stop on the final episode, you will make the face that Neil McCauley makes as he backs away from the car. And it will be this horror of, like, oh no, it's really over, isn't it? Just look at his face in that and know that you have that coming up.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been another awesome episode of One Hit Minute. Connor Ratliff, you can find CONNORRATLIFF on Twitter. Follow him. His Mickey Mouse mega thread is just unbelievable. Much in the spirit of people who are obsessed with this movie, we tend to find ourselves being satiated by obsessive pursuits. So thank you. And I can't promise a minute-by-minute look at an LA Takedown or Robbery Homicide Division podcast, but I may talk to Connor off-air and see if there's a sneaky LA Takedown bonus episode, but we can just dive wholeheartedly into that.
Because I've never seen it. I've always avoided it. I've never seen it.
Oh, my God. Okay, so
I do also counsel that if you can find it and it's available in various illicit ways, I do think Robbery Homicide Division, for people who wonder what a Heat TV show would have been like.
Yes.
It's fascinating. You know, it's a short lived TV show. I think it was on CBS, but it is like the precursor to the look of Collateral, like before when Collateral came out, everyone was like, ooh, look at the look of this movie. He'd already been kind of playing with that.
Yes.
On that show.
Yes.
Yeah. It's definitely worth, it's a good, like, come down from Heat addiction is to, oh, you can watch, it won't be the same majesty as Heat, but it's an interesting sort of follow-up, a sort of epilogue to that movie.
Well, we can definitely do a bonus episode on Robbery Homicide Division. That's a good excuse for me to talk about that show. So we'll stay in touch and we'll make sure we drop that around, you know, a little bit after this one. So those of you out there, there'll be a bonus one after you hear this, but we'll record another time. But look, guys, thank you so much for listening to another episode of One Hit Minute. And I usually finish the show by saying this, which is we'll catch you on another episode of One Hit Minute just around the corner. And the heat is right around the corner, so I'm going to just slowly back away. You'll have to imagine me with Robert De Niro's sad face right now, backing away out of this minute with Connor. We'll catch you in another episode soon. Thanks, guys.